This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Yesterday, several prominent scientists demanded that the federal government guarantee basic research freedoms for scientists working within their ranks. They detailed instances of political interference with science in several federal agencies, the Consumer Product Safety Commission, the Food and Drug Administration, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the Environmental Protection Agency, the National Institutes of Health, and the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health. Among their claims, reports being edited to misrepresent scientific findings, agencies' reluctance to regulate products, scientific findings ignored in policy rulings, and resistance to scientific appointments. Today we're broadcasting from the American Association for the Advancement of Science meeting in Boston, and this hour we're joined by scientists who will make the case for Congress and the next administration to set policies that will ensure the scientific freedom of federal scientists. We're going to talk about the ways to strengthen science in the federal government, from keeping politics out of political appointments to protecting whistleblowers, to ensuring that scientists can present their findings to their peers and the public. And if you'd like to join the discussion, give us a call. Our number is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. And if you're here in the audience at the meeting, we invite you to step up to the mic with your questions. You can also join us in Second Life. Just go to the Science Friday Island there with your avatar. You can pick up a free T-shirt and also ask a question of our avatar over there. As always, you can surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com for more information. Let me introduce my guests. Francesca Griffo is a senior scientist and director of the Scientific Integrity Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists in Washington. Welcome to the program, Dr. Griffo.
Thank you very much.
Welcome. David Goldston was chief of staff for the House Committee on Science from 2001 to 2006. He's a visiting lecturer in the Center for Environment at Harvard, right here in Boston. Well, that's across the river in Cambridge. They hate to mix that up, don't they? I want to mix up Boston and Cambridge in this area. Welcome to the program, David.
Thanks.
Rosina Bierbaum was Associate Director for Environment in the Office of Science and Technology Policy from 1998 to 2001, and Acting Director of the Office of Science and Technology Policy from January to October 2001. She's a professor and dean of the School of Natural Resources and Environment at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. Welcome to the program.
Very pleased to be here. Thank you.
Thanks for taking that long journey. James McCarthy was a co-chair of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the famous IPCC. That was a working group, too. He's president-elect of the American Association for the Advancement of Science and professor of biological oceanography at Harvard in Cambridge. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you.
Good to have you back. Let me begin with you, Dr. Griffo, because it was basically the Union of Concerned Scientists statement that I was quoting at the top of the program. Mm-hmm. Give us an idea of the report that you outlined all kinds of instances in which you think that science and politics were too many times interwoven.
Yes, Ira. I mean, we've been documenting that for a number of years. We've been looking at these various examples, and I would have people go to a very fun feature on our website called the A to Z Guide to Abuses in Science. It's a permutated periodic table of the elements where each element is actually representing an abuse, and they're all very well documented there. But they range, you know, very broadly for all kinds of things, and you mentioned some of them, but I think, you know, falsifying data, fabricating results, selectively editing documents, creating false uncertainty, tampering with scientific procedures. I mean, it's a very long list of the ways. But I think it's not just those specific abuses of science. It's also the more systemic changes that we've seen, the way that insider, you know, games have been played with the rules that are really going to be very challenging to undo.
And what are you calling for then? How are you calling to change all of this?
Well, I think essentially we need to create a situation to create conditions in the federal government where federal scientists can do their jobs. It's not that scientists are, you know, a special class or anything, but in fact, these are very important people in the federal government. They serve the American public. The work they do is important, and we need to give them conditions where they can be effective. Some parts of that are obviously giving them some basic protections. You mentioned whistleblower protections. Other parts of that have to do with transparency, increasing the, you know, we can't be everywhere. We can't be watching. So the point is, if we open up the government, if we have these things more out in the open, then everyone can actually be a part of that conversation and part of the people watching.
David Goldstein, you worked in Congress. Your congressman who you represented, Sherry Bollert, was very instrumental and very open in his ideas about science, shared very much his views about science, and was never afraid to talk about science. Do you agree with the union's concern here about what happened in the past and what might we have to watch out for in the future?
Well, I'm obviously not familiar with each case, but I think there have been problems in terms of abuses of science and efforts to squelch scientists. The most noted and documented example is probably Jim Hansen at NASA, where even NASA acknowledged that people there hadn't been abided by the rules. And that may be also one of the few success stories, because I think the rules that were put in place after that incident, everybody, including Hansen, views as a model of what might be done to institute the kinds of policies that Francesca is calling for. I think the biggest problem is, or at least as big a problem, is self-censorship. The people now are worried that someone else will worry, that someone else will worry, that someone else will worry, and that's much harder to root out. Every time we tried to figure out what was going on at NOAA, for example, where there have been some of these cases, a lot of them were sort of people worrying that the next person up the line was going to create a problem for them, and so they censored themselves. So I think creating a new atmosphere would be helpful beyond actually rooting out real problems, but changing the atmosphere, which I think the reputation and the sense of what's happening is even worse than what was happening, and that's created its own set of problems.
Do you think that any new administration, whether it's Democratic or Republican, will be different?
I think so, but I also think some of these problems are going to continue regardless of what party is in power, because some of them involve really policy disputes that are very close and intermingled to the science disputes. So everybody, scientists and policymakers, tend to frame policy issues as questions, is the science on our side? Because that's easier than having a full-blown debate about the policy differences. And I think that's happened a lot. That's likely to, that happened before this administration. That's going to continue after it. And I think as issues get more difficult, as they have a basis in science, everyone tries to make it sound like the science is determinative. That creates a lot of confusion, and that's likely to continue no matter who's in office.
Mm. Jim McCarthy, you served as co-chair of the IPCC, the working group number two, on climate change. Do you feel that U.S. policies on climate change, the U.S. policies on climate change, are changing? Are they evolving a little bit more now than when the day when President Bush said that a report put out by the State Department was something done by the bureaucracy?
Well, Ira, I think they are, and the disappointment is that it's taken a long time. And if we go back to 2001, when the IPCC report that I was involved in was released, it seemed to many of us that this was the first time the IPCC had identified unequivocally impacts of climate change. One could go back to the earlier report and say, well, there were a lot of hypotheses about future impacts, but for the first time we could see impacts. Moreover, we could see that the negative aspect of those was far outweighing what some people had long thought, well, there will be positives as well. And so just coming back, I think, to this point of the transparency of science, I think the scientists who are involved in studies of this sort are doing this because they believe that the best information should be on the table for the policy process to review. And if in the course of getting to the policy discussion that Dave was just referring to, there's a filtering, there's a selection. Now, we know that every administration, and I liked your opening comment about a case for Congress and for the administration, because I think we have a tendency to focus too much in the administration here. We need to keep in mind that the Congress has a very important role to play in this. And that if in the course of moving from The knowledge base, and we know in some cases if it's military intelligence or perhaps some of the economic information the government has, they would have a reason for not making that public. But the science should be transparent. We should all know what that science is, and any science generated by our federal scientists should be available for all of us to see at all times.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Bierbaum, you sort of had an insider's look at all of this year. Can you give us your perspective and how it looked from there?
Well, I stayed as the acting science advisor for the very long wait for Jack Marburger to show up on Halloween of 2001. And there certainly was, unfortunately, I think, both a systemic distortion and a suppression of science during that time. That's why I signed as one of the 62 original scientists 4 years ago that there were problems in what was happening in terms of health science, in terms of climate science, in terms of national security science, because five administrations worth of advisors in these different areas compared notes, and we felt it had never happened to this extent before. But to pick up on where Jim McCarthy led us in terms of 2001, so here it is, Inauguration Day 2001. I'm left holding the OSTP mantle. We gavel down at exactly 12 noon inauguration time the sentence that says most of the warming in the last 50 years is due to humans. And we all thought, we have a new president. We have a strong, clear science statement. We have a mandate to act. And, of course, it was within weeks that the U.S. walked from the Kyoto Protocol. Also, the National Academy of Sciences was asked to critique, in a kind sense, the IPCC. But the science office, which I was representing, was not asked to help define those questions. The climate change science program was reorganized so that it reported through political channels, not to the Office of Science and Technology Policy. We were told we no longer needed to send in weekly science reports over to the West Wing. They would call us if they needed us. And so it was a very sharp sea change in sort of the attention to science in general and the attention to this very strong climate science that was coming through the community loud and clear.
All right, we have to take a short break. We're going to come back and talk lots more about science and the role of science in public policy and how we can get more and better science opinions without being filtered or censored out to the public or actually to be published. So stay with us. Our number 1-800-989-8255. If you're here in the audience, you can go right here to the microphone sitting here waiting for you. Don't be shy and don't be afraid. We'll be right back after this short break. I'm Ira Flatto. This is Talk of the Nation, Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation, Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatto. We're talking this hour about strengthening science in the federal government with my guests, Francesca Griffo of the Union of Concerned Scientists, David Goldston, former chief of staff for the House Committee on Science and visiting lecturer at Harvard, Rosina Bierbaum, a scientist who served in the Office of Science and Technology Policy in both the Clinton and Bush administration and now a dean at the University of Michigan, James McCarthy, co-chair of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change Working Group 2, and the new president-elect of the AAAS, our number 1-800-989-8255. Dr. Bierbaum, you were making some points about being on the inside of the, I guess, what you might call the Office of the Science Advisor. It's also always informally. Does the science advisor, or did it have much of an input on hardly anything in this administration, the last administration, in your experience?
Well, I felt in the last administration it really did have a big impact. There were four associate directors who were all Senate confirmed, keeping their eye on different pieces of the environmental research budget as well as the policy development. But I think I would argue that every major decision that was made in the Clinton administration had a scientist at the table. And science was often not the loudest voice, but it was a voice. And so whether it was regulations or whether it was the science input to treaties or whether it was what the federal environmental budget should be or all of the science budget should be, there would be a scientist there arguing extensively for that. So Jack Gibbons and then Neil Lane were always central to all the decision making. All that changed, though. It was very hard to get a seat at any table in the 10 months that I was staying as the acting advisor. And so, for example, with CEQ, the Council on Environmental Quality, becoming really the default climate empire in the White House. That was very different. When energy policy was put together in the Bush administration, the National Economics Council was the lead on that, not the Science Advisor's Office.
David Galton, did your boss have any better luck with getting attention for science? Let me just specifically, on this program last January, a year ago, you said that climate change was one of the areas that the new Congress would make its mark on. Well, how would you grade that new Congress?
Incomplete.
Now that you're a professor, you can give those grades.
That's right, and I was familiar with that grade as a student, too. I would say what I said, I think, in January was the one science issue where the change in party control might make a difference is climate. And I think that actually has proven to be the case. There were very few hearings on climate with Republicans in charge of the Congress. In the Senate, where Senator Inhofe chaired the Environment Committee, there were mostly hearings about how climate was a quote-unquote hoax. I think that's all changed. I think climate is very much on the agenda. There are bills in both houses. The energy bill moved through is less than what some of us would have liked, but certainly a heck of a lot more than what had been done in recent years, including the first increase in CAFE standards and fuel economy standards for several decades. So I think that did change because of the party control. And the other thing that's happening, which Jim McCarthy indicated, is that even within the Republican side, even within the administration, there's a little bit more movement about we have to talk about what to do about this. I think the bulk of the Republicans are still not ready to go to mandatory controls, which my boss thought was needed.
And your boss was a Republican.
Yes, and which the presumptive nominee of the Republican Party has supported, right? So even though it's not what he's emphasizing right now. But so I think the climate issue is far more fluid than it was a year ago. That's partly because of change in political control and also partly because of the impact of the most recent IPCC report. Even the press coverage of climate change significantly after that, all the trying to balance with some quotes from the few scientists or former scientists who weren't part of the consensus on climate, a lot of that has fallen away. So I think that issue has really changed both because of the science and because of the politics. But I think there's a case where that means we're no longer hopefully going to be debating the science, the kinds of things that the Bush administration did ask the Academy to look into. But we are going to be debating what to do about it, and that's a policy question. There is no science position on whether you should have a carbon tax. There is no science position on the values question, even if this is a problem that's worth dealing with. I certainly think that it is, but I think what is going to happen now is we're moving past the science debate to a policy debate, and the way scientists need to think about that and participate is different from the place we have been stuck in for the last decade or so.
In what way?
In that before, there really was a debate about what does the science tell us, a political debate about what the science tells us. And I think now there is already much broader acceptance that we are facing human-induced climate change, and the question is what to do about it. That's largely a policy question. I would also say that many discussions about the way science and politics intersect that are held right now really view climate as the model issue. And I think it's really an unusual issue. It's rare that the political debate is centered on a purely scientific question, which it was because there was this, at least in Congress, debate about whether climate change was real, and that there's a clear consensus answer. Usually scientists are more divided. Here, there's not only a clear consensus answer, but a codified clear consensus answer in IPCC, and it's going to take a while for that to move through the system. Generally, the opening question is only partly science, if science at all, and the answer the community can give is much more variable. So climate's unusual that way, and it's going to now be shifting, I think, to a much more policy-centered debate.
Let me ask all of you. Let me begin with Dr. Griffo. Are there then issues, because the environment has become and has ballooned, so to speak, as a bigger issue, are there other important issues that are now under the radar screen with science and policy? I think about the situation with the FDA, for example. You know, it doesn't get talked about as much as it might have. Other kinds of issues that are important but are not being discussed.
Well, I'll just jump in. I mean, I think that there are these issues across the agencies. I mean, this is not just about climate when we look at the political interference issues. We have survey results from 9 different agencies where we have 1,191 scientists who have told us that they fear retaliation. So those are all not, you know, climate scientists. It's clearly much, much more broad than that.
Mm-hmm. And are they're willing to speak up more now? Are they able to speak up more now than they used to be?
Well, it's interesting because I think, you know, you referred to the NASA example, and I think that NASA and NOAA, particularly NOAA, really tried after these events to change things. And unfortunately, shortly after that, a new media policy came down from the Department of Commerce that essentially was about 15 pages long, all about you can do it, but it's only in this condition and you have to. And it was a very, I think, frightening document for a federal federal scientist. And only at the very end did it say, well, actually, you do have a few protections. So I think very good people and you know, various agencies are trying to make things better. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, because we have this centralization top down, it's very difficult.
Jim, you look like you wanted to jump in. Let me ask everybody here, if you'd like to get up to the mic and ask a question, there's space for you to do that. Yes, Jim.
Actually, I was getting edgy when David was speaking. I think one way to interpret David's message would be that the case for really understanding the science of climate change is pretty much past, and now we're talking about policy. And I really strongly disagree with that. I think if you just look at the last 4 or 5 years and say, well, where did we think we could possibly realistically imagine policy measures taking us in terms of a altered course for the future, a reduced concentration of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere? And when the science plays out, when you look at our understanding of the system and the models that project various futures, it's pretty clear that it would be a world that would be so different from what we have today that it's interesting now to see that not only is it a sense among the scientific community who look at these things, but even in the political realm. If you could have imagined just 4 years ago the leading contenders in the primaries advocating a reduction of fossil fuel emissions by 80%, or let's say greenhouse gases by 80% by 2050, it was unthinkable. And yet, if you look and say, well, what will that world be like? There are many aspects of it that I think we'd be awfully uncomfortable with. So I think the policy has to be continually informed by what the science can tell us as to what the implications of particular policy measures might be. And it's an iterative process, and that's what we need to work on.
And I agree with that entirely. What I meant to say was before there was an issue that was purely science being asked, and that's now we're at these issues where it is entangled and it is iterative, and it has to be informed by policy, but science can no longer be determinative. The issue, is climate change real, is an issue where science alone should and can speak to answer that question. The kinds of questions now, what level should we set greenhouse gas emissions at, that's an answer where science has to be one input, and that input needs to be constantly refreshed, and the research behind it needs to be constantly funded. But the science alone can't determine the answer to that policy question. So that's where I think the distinction is. But I don't differ with anything that Jim just said.
Hmm. So who should take the lead in these things? Should the science advisor, should the president's science advisor have some sort of autonomy to speak up when he or she would like to without feeling like their job is in jeopardy?
That's not the role of the science advisor. I mean, the science advisor's in the White House. They should certainly feel free to speak mm-hmm. to the president, which has worked better in some administrations than others. But the science advisor is not a freestanding civil service science office. The kinds of agencies that Francesca was listing are, and each agency has its own curious problem. So part of the problem with the Commerce Department document was they put out a document that applied to the entire department, scientists and non-scientists. There was a lot of debate within the department, and I assure you we suggested that was not the way to do this. And so they put out a document that refers to, you know, what some economists may say about economic policy and confuse that with what a scientist might say about their own scientific work, not a policy matter, and that's why the final policy came out so inadequately.
So should a strong congressperson have a voice in these things? I mean, who decides the direction of science? You know, we never hear that debate coming up very much. It always sort of is an undercurrent when some problem. But we don't talk about, we don't hear very much. There may be hearings going on, but we never hear very much about them.
Well, I think both the exact, I mean, it gets to this issue of independence. I mean, that's one of those issues that's in between. So you want science directed in part to answer questions that are of interest to policymakers. You also want it partly driven by the community. And so Congress is generally, by and large, there are exceptions, set broad guidance on this is a general area we should look at. Climate science, say, should be funded. But then not getting into the specific areas in detail because that would be viewed as something that the community should look at by itself. But I think we do need some direction. I mean, in certain areas, for example, NASA inadequately funding remote sensing that we need for climate change, Congress has had to step in and say, no, we need more of that.
Well, I definitely think that we can't do all good science at once. And so we need to have some strategic planning exercises. The science community is actually very bad at setting priorities within a discipline, let alone across disciplines. But that's going to become increasingly important as these budgets get tighter and tighter. And so I think the effort that the National Science and Technology Council attempted under the previous president and under the science advisors of Clinton to kind of coordinate across the federal agencies to think about emerging areas, to figure out how much needed to be put as federal entities into high-risk, longer-term research, as well as what kind of applied or near-term solutions we need, was a very valuable exercise. I think we've lost some ground now, but I think there does need to be a strategic planning process. And in those exercises, 13 agencies would kind of horse trade issues, databases, and try to figure out what was knowable in what time frame. And just to come back to whether the climate science is settled for a second, I think, yes, we know the climate's changing, and yes, we know it's changing fast. But you know what? We don't know what to do about it, not just in terms of mitigation, but in terms of how to cope with climate change, because no matter what we do on the emission side, the changes are going to continue. And that is a very rich and underattended to research agenda, coping with climate change. We've lost a decade in thinking about that. The first national assessment of the impacts of climate change on the U.S. mandated by Congress was effectively subverted by the Bush administration, sank like a stone, except for UCS and a few others bringing back these pieces. And the 10-year plan that the Clinton administration was attempting to put forward would have addressed a lot of those issues of what can communities do, what are regional impacts, what are socioeconomic solutions to climate change. And we've really got a very urgent research agenda there.
Okay. We're talking about Science This Hour and Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Here in Boston at the American Association for the Advancement of Science meeting, talking about science and public policy and the directions and how the two may live better together. Honestly, let's go to the audience for a question here. Right, young lady right here.
Yes. Hi, I'm actually visiting from Southern California, where we've recently been having a large policy issue with the greenhouse gas waiver that California tried to pass, but the EPA denied. And I was wondering, based on the policy end of it, the national standard would call for less greenhouse gas emissions 4 years earlier than California's would. And I was wondering if you think, this is sort of directed to anyone, if you think California's greenhouse gas emissions standard was reasonable.
Anybody want to tackle it?
It looks like you.
Yeah. David?
Well, I think that the administration probably should have granted the waiver. There isn't the precedent to not grant a waiver, although there are some tricky legal issues because of the way that mileage is regulated rather than clean air standards. But on the specifics of whether it's the best number from a scientific point of view or what the implications are from a scientific point of view, I would turn to the scientists.
I feel like it's if you remember that it's I've got a secret, but people were jockeying to stand up, and I didn't want to stand up first. Yes.
I'd just like to point out, I mean, this is a really good example of leadership at a level where we wouldn't necessarily have expected it, that to see states now taking the positions that they are, to see communities taking the positions they are, to see the voice of people being heard locally and at the state level, and yet quite a disconnect when we get to the sort of issues that have been raised here with regard to the federal policy.
This is unusual for states to stand up, but they've been doing it in across the board in different issues. Pollution that's moved from state to state, the car regulations, things like that.
Yeah, we've seen, and the leadership of governors and the leadership of mayors have really been extraordinarily prominent in this area.
And some of them are banding together. They create little regional issues, right, Francesca, instead of...
Yeah, no, I think that what we're seeing is when the federal government does not fulfill its responsibility, when the conditions there are not such that these things can happen, the states are stepping into the void.
All right, I think the states have done this in a lot of areas. The thing that makes it unusual in climate change is it's not a problem that just affects one region, and the impact any state or region can make is limited, and yet they're still doing it. I think it's a sign of, you know, the ideological polarization and stalemate in Washington, right, which has caused everything to go further down.
We'll talk more about that and your questions. Our number 1-800-989-8255. Stay with us. We'll be right back from Boston after this short break. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Talk of the Nation, Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation, Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about science and public policy in the federal government. My guests are Francesca Griffo, Director of the Scientific Integrity Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists, David Goldston, former Chief of Staff for the House Committee on Science, and he's visiting lecturer at Harvard, Rosina Bierbaum, former administrator in the Office of Science and Technology Policy in both the Clinton and Bush administrations and now dean of the School of Natural Resources and Environment at the University of Michigan, James McCarthy, co-chair of the IPCC Working Group 2 and professor of biological oceanography at Harvard University. Our number 1-800-989-8255. Let's get a question from the phones here. Let's see if we can go to John. Or is it Don there? Hi, Don. Are you there? Well, let's go to the audience here. We'll go to the right side. Hi.
Hi. Since we've been talking about leadership and advice, I wanted to ask the panelists if they would nominate someone in particular they would like to see as science advisor.
Aha. Uh-huh.
Well, I don't have a name, but I will dive in there and say that the important thing is that it is someone who comes in early. I mean, the fact that Rosina was saying that, you know, Dr. Marburger didn't come in until Halloween, from January 20th or around that time for the inauguration, for there to be no one in place for those 9 months or almost 10 months is just ridiculous. So I think the key thing is that we get someone who's at the table.
Do you need someone who is a better organizer or a better scientist? What do you think, David? Is someone who knows how to play politics or is going to stick to the hard science?
Well, hopefully those aren't two absolutely mutually exclusive personal traits, even though it should be someone who can tell the difference between when he's doing or she is doing one or the other. I think, you know, historically the thing that's mattered most is the science advisor having a personal relationship of some sort with the president, or at least the president being open to setting up such a relationship. I mean, there have been lots of efforts by statute and other ways to try to strengthen the science advisor. It's never worked, because it's not a line office with a lot of responsibilities. The person either has the presidency or doesn't, and so that's really the thing that you have to look at the most.
Rosina, what would you say?
I agree that you need someone who's both a good scientist but also a good synthesizer. It has to be someone who plays well with others and understands when science can be the loudest voice and explain the box that science puts you in as you develop regulations and policy around it, but doesn't let anyone get out of the box. But I think it's also important that this person take advantage of the fact that you can have 4 Senate-confirmed associate directors, because that's 4 very powerful people to cover areas the science. And very important, I think we should revert to what the first President Bush did, and that is make the head of the Office of Science and Technology Policy also truly the science advisor, in that they are named a special assistant to the president. That's a separate reporting line that does not exist now, and I think that's a great loss.
1-800-989-8255. Frank in Yarnhill. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Yes, hello.
Hi there.
Out here in the Amhill, Oregon.
Hi, go ahead.
I'm very interested in asking your panelists, a great conversation here, to perhaps talk about the relationship between science, religion, moral decision-making, and public policy. For example, the systematic efforts in recent years. I think many people would agree that efforts to raise all sorts of doubts about the science of global warming. We saw before that the effort to raise doubts about the question of smoking. It seems to me that this isn't just a question of science and politics. In many cases, it's a question of science and perhaps versions of religion that are not quite so, I think, open-minded, and questions of the nature of moral decision-making. So science and other disciplines and the cross, you know, fertilization that comes from that interaction, I'm looking hopefully to the future beyond this administration, wondering if the panelists could speak to this.
All right, good question. How do we handle that?
Well, one thing I'd like to say is that I think all of the major religious groups of the world have actually made a statement now that climate change is a moral challenge. And I think it was very telling when the evangelicals came out with their very powerful statement a little more than a year ago that called for acting now. And I believe that the Catholic bishop's statement was very powerful, saying, we're not scientists, but we believe what the science says, and we have a moral responsibility to those who follow us to leave them a sustainable planet. And we do have the possibility of being the first generation to leave the next a truly irreversible problem. I think the promotion of giving up carbon for Lent is a very interesting thing that some of the religious groups are talking about, too. So I actually think religion and climate change have found a useful pairing.
Jim?
No, I would just echo that comment. Every interaction I've had with religious groups over the last few years has led me to believe that there is no fundamental difference between our concern for the future of the planet, whether we call it creation care or anything else. We're all talking about the same thing. I see no conflict at all with any religious group with which I've had an interaction.
David?
But I think we need to make a distinction between cases where religious groups are taking issue with the science, evolution obviously being the most prominent case and most serious, and issues where they're taking issue with policy that around the science, say stem cells, where I think that's sometimes the way it's argued, again, muddies the waters, but fundamentally, that's not a debate over the nature of stem cells and what we know scientifically. It's a religious debate, ethical debate about how we proceed and what we do research on and so forth. I think that's legitimate. Obviously, groups weighing in on moral questions involving what we do about climate change, that's different from weighing in on the findings of the science itself, which is why the evolution controversy is so difficult.
Well, because you brought up the word debate, you wrote something in Nature, an article in Nature, is it this week in Nature, where you opposed the idea of having a science debate 2008 among the presidential candidates here. And I want to give you an opportunity for you to state your reasons why.
So I wouldn't quite say oppose. I'd say people are rushing into it without thinking about it, and that it my guess is that it would do nothing to either nothing or create a backlash, so that's close to a post. But I raised a couple of issues.
I can see your years on the Hill are paying off.
A couple of issues. Number one is that some of the issues that have been slated for a science debate are, again, policy issues, not science, and to send the message that this is about who's good on science is misleading. I would love to hear a debate about what the candidates think about climate change or energy policy. That's not fundamentally a science issue. Secondly, I think there's this sense that scientists have, because the budget doesn't work out the way they would most prefer and so forth, that nobody's paying attention, they don't get respected and so forth, when actually they are held actually in fairly high esteem, and so that some of the reasons behind the debate are suspect. There's an assumption that making something a higher profile political issue will necessarily pay off in financial dividends. That hasn't always been the case. Science agencies don't necessarily do better when they're in the public spotlight. And finally, given that there's all this concern about politicization of science, that's one of the things behind the debate, putting science in the middle of the most politicized kind of discussion you could possibly have doesn't seem to me to be the most likely or way to tamp down that concern. If you want a debate about what's politics, what's science, having it in a big, loud, brash forum doesn't seem to be the way to settle that. So my point is not that science is separate from politics, not that scientists shouldn't be involved in politics. In fact, my fear is that they're trying to take a shortcut doing something that's largely show business and not getting involved in sort of the day-to-day politics, which is much more likely to pay off. And if we look at what's the way debates have worked so far and what kinds of issues they're good at and what kinds of impressions they leave, I don't think that maps very well with what the advocates of the science debate are looking for.
Okay. 1-800-989-8255, if anybody of our members want to rebut that.
Well, let me just say very briefly, we're in an interesting situation.
You're wearing a science debate 2008 button for folks that can't see that at home. It's people to know.
And on the steering committee.
And also, Francesca is also a supporter.
And so, Dave, you know, for the first time in my memory, you can correct me if you remember otherwise, we have statements on websites right now. They weren't websites way back when, but there are public statements by the leading contenders in the primaries right now saying where their interests are, what their priorities would be. And I come back to what Rosina said, that one of the roles of the federal government, and certainly leadership at the highest level, is to help guide this question of priorities. So, you know, I don't think a debate has to be loud and brash. I think to have a discussion to allow us to see, I mean, candidates who, for the, you know, there was nothing like this 4 years ago. We saw nothing from the candidates 4 years earlier, just on the issue of climate change. You couldn't really tell the difference between Mr. Bush's and Mr. Gore's positions. They both said, if elected, I will reduce CO2 emissions. But we have some really thoughtful statements from the candidates now, and I think it would be helpful for all of us to hear those articulated and see where some of the differences are.
Okay, let's go to the audience here. Yes.
Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Lelia Graham. I'm a second-year graduate student in technical and scientific communication at James Madison University in Virginia. And Ira, I wanted to go back to a question that you asked a few minutes ago about who controls the direction of science. That's actually something we've been discussing over the past couple of weeks in one of my classes, specifically the science of climate and policy. And I wanted to ask the panelists how they feel about privately funded think tanks and their strong steering of legislature as opposed to the public opinion, any man getting out in the street and saying this is what we're interested in. What do you feel about these privately funded think tanks controlling?
Could you name a couple that you're thinking about, for example? Do you have one or two in mind?
I'd prefer not to.
Oh, okay. Trying to get a few facts in here, but it's okay. Well, it's a good question.
I mean,
David, you want to start?
Sure.
Someone who's been the target of these think tanks, perhaps?
Right. I think think tanks are part of the process, just like everyone else. I think some think tanks do more thinking than others. And I think
would another name be lobbyists for these people?
Well, actually, so the concern is a concern that I have about the think tank community is not them being involved. A couple of things. One is funding should be transparent, which it isn't. That doesn't mean that immediately because someone got funding from X, you should discount them, but you shouldn't have a chance to know. The other thing is there are think tanks actually on both sides of the ideological divide that I think tend to do open, intellectually honest work, and there are others that basically have become arms of a party or an industry where you can predict what they're going to do before you open it up, and the if you go and check some of what's in there, it's not as convincing. And I think it's a marketplace of ideas. It's up to the people who are on the receiving end to make that distinction, but I don't see anything pernicious about the fact that think tanks are out there. There should be much more openness about where the funding is, but I think people have a sense of which ones are basically lobbying groups under another name and which ones are more broadly believed. And then there are honest broker organizations for disputes like the National Academy of Sciences, the Health Effects Institute, that even in this polarized environment still are viewed as a place where people can generally go and get an opinion that is at least hard to dismiss without having looked at it closely.
National Research Council.
Right, which is the arm of the Academy. So I think we need very much to protect the reputation and credibility of those entities because honest brokers are few and far between these days.
Talking about science of public policy this hour and talk of the nation's Science Friday from NPR News. Here from in Boston. Let's go to this side of the room. Yes.
Thank you. I'm Holly Given with Consortium for Ocean Leadership in Washington. And I'd like to ask the panel to what extent they feel agency funding and the interagency process have been used to influence policy as informed or maybe as not informed by science.
When you say agencies, what do you
mean? Oh, federal agencies that have employ the federal scientists that we began talking about today, yeah.
Go ahead, Francesca.
Okay. I mean, I think there are two separate debates. There's this broad question of the overview levels of science for those agencies, and I want to set that aside because that is certainly, you know, a conversation that takes place between Congress and the whole appropriations. But I think one of the things that we've observed is within agencies that we have observed some programs being penalized, programs that were going to perhaps produce results, scientific results, that were going to be inconvenient for policy decisions that the administration wanted to make. And I think that is a pernicious kind of scary thing. I mean, I think there are big examples of that, like the NASA mission to Earth satellite systems that the National Academies has documented, some of those programs not being fully funded and being cut, which will really interfere with our ability to observe the Earth and understand the Earth. But also smaller ones like the Toxic Release Inventory, which is a very important program, if you don't know about it, that really means that all you have to do is go type in your zip code and you can find out what the various industries in your area are emitting. And that's an incredibly valuable tool, and there has been assault after assault on that particular program in this administration. So I think it really, there are two different bits about the funding there.
But I think it's
very
also
distinct.
One of the things Francesca said just sort of underscores the problem with having a politicized atmosphere, because then it taints the discussion of everything. So the NASA definitely cut back on Earth science. I was very involved in trying to reverse that. But I don't think that had anything to do with the politics of climate science. That had to do with internal issues in NASA and the interests of the administrator and the cost of the shuttle and so forth. And frankly, in the 09 budget, they've actually reversed that. They've reversed it by taking money from other stuff that I'd rather see funded as well. But I don't think that that was really a political decision. But the fact that someone can raise a question about whether it was or not shows the danger of when everything gets politicized, it's very hard to have those kinds of discussions. So that it's an interesting case.
You think we're entering, I have about a minute left, do you think we're entering a different era now, where we may be able to have those discussions, or are the waters so poisoned that it's going to take a long time?
I think it really does partly depend on what happens in November. Regardless of which side wins, I think there'll be an effort to start again that any new administration has, regardless of party, and it'll depend on whether they really try to directly address this concern.
Mm-hmm. Rosina, do you think how quickly a new science advisor gets appointed will tell us about the future?
Absolutely. The Clinton administration appointed theirs by Christmas, and he still got back to sing in his Christmas choir. I think that's very important. You got to be part of the team that's building what's going to happen in this White House, setting the strategic direction, and be a real player. Yes, early is better. Very important.
Early is better, but the Clinton administration was almost unique in getting somebody in that quickly because of the connection that Vice President Gore had with the science community. So I would say I wouldn't view that as an absolute indicator, although it would certainly be great if someone were appointed early.
And there you have it. We've run out of time. I'd like to thank all my guests, Francesca Griffo, Director of the Scientific Integrity Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists, David Goldston, former Chief of Staff for the House Committee on Science. He's now visiting lecturer at Harvard University. Rosina Bierbaum, former Administrator in the Office of Science and Technology Policy, and she is Dean of the School of Natural Resources and Environment at the University of Michigan. And James McCarthy, co-chair of the IPCC Working Group 2 and now professor of biological oceanography at Harvard University. Thank you all for taking time to be with us today.
Thank
our
you,
program
Ira.
Is produced by Karen Vergoth and senior producer Annette Heiss. Charles Berquist is our director. Flora Lichtman is our producer for digital media. Shuman Ma, our Metcalf fellow. Josh Rogerson is our technical director. Our audio engineers are Kim Jones and Josh Rogerson here in Boston. Drew Reynolds and Nathan Mark in Washington. And we had help today from director Sarah Handel in Washington. If you missed any of the stuff we talked about today, you can surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com, where we're podcasting and blogging. We're actually videoing this meeting today. We'll be up there on our website with our other videos, hoping that you'll also send us some of your videos that we might feature on Science Friday. And we're also looking for blogging and your participation in anything we do on our website. I'm Ira Flatow in Boston.